This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 189.
This podcast is brought to you by the Tallahassee Marathon. Experience Florida's capital city at the Tallahassee Marathon and Half Marathon on February 5th, 2017. Listeners to this podcast can receive a $10 discount on registration using the code PODCAST. Experience the dynamic new course that has revitalized this 43-year-old race. Visit TallahasseeMarathon.com to register.
Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where it's all about empowering you to run a marathon and change your life. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we talk with marathon great Frank Shorter, who won the 1972 Olympic Marathon, ignited a running boom, and inspired a generation. You'll hear his story and get his top advice for beginners in the marathon distance. And just a reminder, you can get expert help in your training by visiting MarathonTrainingAcademy.com and clicking on the Join the Academy link. Well, the time of this recording, the Olympics officially concluded a couple days ago. It was a lot of fun watching not just the men's marathon on that final day, but all the events that we got time to watch. Now we just have to wait 4 more years, Angie, till
or 2 more years until the Winter Olympics.
Yes, which is also a lot of fun. So give us a quick recap of the marathon event, which is appropriate because we are talking with, on this episode, an Olympic marathoner. Actually, the last American man to win a gold medal in the Olympics was Frank Shorter back in 1972.
That's
so
right.
What a privilege to talk to him. And I know you folks are going to enjoy this conversation, but Angie, give us a quick recap of the 2016 Olympic contest.
Well, it was definitely very interesting to watch. It was a rather warm morning, not as bad as what the women had. It was around 70 degrees, but very humid and it had been raining. So a lot of the course was very slick, as the announcers so graciously told us.
Yeah, that's why Meb slipped at the very end.
Right, right. Yeah, a lot of people had challenging races. There were some who had to pull out of the race due to not feeling well, and others who had slower times. But the gold medal went to Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya with a time of 2 hours, 8 minutes, 44 seconds. He ran really strong. I mean, there was pretty much no doubt that he was going to win. He owned it.
Yeah, he was killing it.
The silver went to Feyisa Lalisa of Ethiopia in 2 hours, 9 minutes, and 54 seconds. And I don't know if anyone noticed when he finished, he made fists and crossed his arms over his head.
Mm-mm.
He made that sign. And I read later that apparently it was in protest to the Ethiopian government, who has been relocating his people group. And apparently there have been like over 400 people killed and a lot imprisoned.
Oh, wow.
So there's speculation whether he's going to even be able to go back to Ethiopia without reprisal.
Wow.
Apparently, they didn't even show the marathon finish in Ethiopia because of his protests. So I thought that was very interesting.
I don't remember seeing that. I'll have to go back and watch the rewind of that now.
Yeah, I really didn't make anything of it at the time. But then when I saw that article, I was like, oh, that makes sense.
Hmm.
And the bronze medal went to Galen Rupp of the United States in 2 hours, 10 minutes, and 5 seconds. And we'd like to, of course, give a shout out to the other U.S. team members. Jared Ward finished in 2 hours, 11 minutes, and 30 seconds. And Meb Kifleski, he finished in 2 hours, 16 minutes, and 46 seconds. And obviously not a stellar race for him. Apparently, he stopped 7 times. He vomited, had dry heaves, and then, of course, slipped at the finish line. But, you know, he's just such an amazing competitor, such great character that, you know, he managed to pull it off with class.
Can you imagine stopping 7 times and falling at the finish line and still finishing in 2:16?
No. It'd be like 6:16 for me.
Meb is kind of special because we went to an event that he spoke at and we got to shake his hand. So we were watching him come across the finish line. He slipped and then I don't think he was even across yet. He was right at it, slipped and hit the ground and just did a couple push-ups. Like, oh, I meant to do that.
Right.
That's kind of what I would do too.
I would think of doing something like that later.
Angie would do the worm across the finish line. That'd be epic.
I would wish the earth would swallow me whole probably.
Well, it's nice to get great feedback from folks in our community who are training with us. We'd just like to give a word of congrats to some people here. So I'll let Angie do that.
Yes, this note comes from JJ in California. She says, I just had one of my short-term running goals come true, which is to be placed in Corral A for the Disneyland Half Marathon in September. This was largely due to Angie's amazing job as a coach and all the support that MTA has given me since I've been a member. After catching the flu this past weekend and only getting in 6.5 miles of my 18-mile long run, this was actually proof that I'm on track for my long-term goals, regardless of any minor setbacks.
Well, that's great to hear. We love hearing that kind of report. And Angie, what's the procedure for getting in Corral A at the Disney Marathon?
Well, you have to time qualify. And basically, the corrals go all the way from A to J. So, okay. You know, she's going to be right up front. And I know she's going to have a very strong race.
Yes. She's one of those people that like completely loves Disney, like totally Disney 100%.
Yes, she does.
She's the one that got married at Disneyland?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, perfect. This will be a half marathon for the storybooks.
Definitely. This next note comes from Academy member Pat from Hawaii. He says, I didn't get a medal for the Hickman Air Force Base half marathon today, but I did get a lovely wooden pineapple for my third place finish in the old people's division, which is 50 to 59.
Old people's division.
He says, that's how we do it in Hawaii, peeps.
Yeah, and he posted a picture of his pineapple. It's a pretty cool thing to get at a race.
Yeah, it's like a, kind of like a, you could put dip or chips, and it's really substantial and very cool.
You can drill a hole through it and hang it up like a medal.
That's what you would do.
I always tell Angie, if she's going to go run a marathon and they don't give out a medal, then she has to come back with an age group award. So she has something to show for it.
And I just ignore you. And this last note comes from Academy member Cecile. She is from the Bahamas. She says, I marked my 55th birthday yesterday with half marathon number 11 in 11 months in Madison, Wisconsin.
So she's done 11 half marathons in 11 months and traveling to boot, you know, to these marathons.
Exactly.
So definitely happening to life instead of letting life happen to her, as they say.
I think it's a great way to celebrate your birthday. So happy birthday, Cecile, and keep up the great work.
Yes, definitely. Well, just like to say congrats to all of you out there who are taking action and seeing progress in your running and in your health. I hope you're inspired by this interview with Frank Shorter. Talking to him is like talking to living history. You know, he's been called the father of the American running boom. When he won the gold medal in the Olympic marathon in 1972 in Munich, it inspired so many people to get into running back in the 70s. And of course, Frank was friends and colleagues with a lot of the other great runners that you read about today, like Steve Prefontaine. Frank's new book is called My Marathon, Reflections on a Gold Medal Life. And our conversation here spans many decades as we kind of hit the highlights of his life and of the book. So you're going to hear about his strategy for winning the marathon in Munich, something bizarre that happened right at the end. You'll also hear about his training philosophy, his track workouts, how he deals with pain, his childhood, and bizarre twists and turns in his very full life. Plus, you'll get lots of great tips for running your first marathon. So I hope that whets your appetite. Let's go ahead and get into our conversation with Frank Shorter right now. Well on my way, well on my way. All right, we're on the podcast now with Frank Shorter, author of the new book, My Marathon, Reflections on a Gold Medal Life. Frank, welcome to the MTA podcast.
Oh, well, thanks. This is great. Love the technology. I'm not very good at it, but I like it.
Yes, we are talking via video Skype. Frank's in Colorado and glad to get connected. We just finished the book. It's a great book. I know a lot of people that listen to this interview are going to go out and buy it. But let's start off with, take us back to the beginning. And tell us, how did you get started with this whole running thing?
Well, it really was an escape from my childhood. And as I've talked to people about the book, it's become more apparent to me that, you see, I had nine siblings. And we were in a huge house in a tiny town in upstate New York. And my father was the savior family doctor in the community, 22,000. But he was the savior by day, and some of my sisters. I have six sisters, and he was a sociopath, and he was one of those rare individuals who didn't want his children to exceed him.
Wow!
He actually competed. If you look back, and I think people who, if they do the reading, will kind of sense. He tried to, not only did he abuse physically, mentally, and sexually, unfortunately, with regard to my sisters and perhaps some of their friends, he was a master manipulator and would constantly be pitting children against each other and creating, in essence, a prison in the household. And my mother, the way to put it there was, she told me when I became an adult, she said, you know, I never left the house anymore after you were about 5, 6 years old, because every time I left, something bad would happen. And so, you know, that's what we knew. But I think at about the age of 5, during one of the beatings, he would come home late at night. We never really saw him. He never went to any of our childhood activities. I don't think he ever read a report card. I don't think he ever went to a school meeting, parent-teacher conference. But he would come home late at night, sometimes drunk, sometimes not, interrogate my mother, and then come up the stairs, and we would have to wait to see who he was going to drag out of the room and beat up. That sort of gives you an idea of what it was like. At about age 8, I had started a pattern of spending time at my friends' houses. There was a YMCA up the street, a great place, all sorts of activity. And I found motion and being outside and being other places and being active was comforting for me. It was a release. And then I realized at about age 8, I was starting to run to the YMCA, to my friends' houses. And I discovered running. And what I discovered was I love moving across the ground that way. I went out and ran this morning, and I was thinking about our talk today. And I was thinking, you know, it's the same now. I'm slower, but I just love moving this way. And so in essence, I started running as stress relief when I was 8 years old. And then I said, well, if I'm doing it this way, I might as well run to and from school. So I was about 10 and school was 2.3 miles away. And I would carry my books. And the way I put it, when I was out there on the sidewalk, my father was not an athletic person, and I felt safe. You know, I just had this feeling, whatever the feeling was, even though I was a little kid, he can't catch me.
Right, exactly. You're free from him during those moments, probably.
Yeah, I'm free. So, yeah. And then in gym class, I actually convinced the gym teacher to allow me to run laps around the field rather than play flag football or whatever it was. Because
what,
I was
wants
training
to run laps?
But I think they let me do it because in both cases, they felt I'd get over it. They thought, oh, it'll only last so long. But the other thing, if you want proof of the story, if you look at video of me running, I carry my left arm differently because that was the arm in which I carried my books, and I had a lot of books. And so that's how I got into the running. And I had no idea that it was going to carry me anywhere other than around the town. And at that time, I really thought that the academics was my escape route. And so that's really the way it went. And I did the same thing in prep school. I went to a prep school called Northfield Mount Hermon, and they just coincidentally had the best cross-country team in all of prep school New England, perennial champions of the league. And again, used the running and the cross country. I was good at it, but again, it was part of the stress relief and something I could reward myself with once all my studies were done for the day. And so I developed that pattern of using the running, and then it continued. I was admitted to Yale and got to Yale and found a whole great group of runners on the cross country and track team. So to continue the narrative, you know, at the end, I was pre-med. And I'm one of those people that needs to get things done early. And by spring break of my senior year, I had submitted my senior paper, which you have to do in your major, which for me was psychology. I was a pre-med psychology major, incidentally specializing in early childhood development.
Interesting.
Which I think is no coincidence.
Yes.
And so I started to train harder. And by the end of my senior year in college, I finished first in the NCAA 6 mile, which was run on a Friday, and was second in the 3 mile, which was run on a Saturday. Then they ran miles rather than meters.
Right.
So again, it just sort of, that's how it started. I guess the thread that runs through it, and what I hope people get from this is that, you know, for me, it was just, I realized when I graduated from college that I was very, very good at what I had done for stress relief from the age of 8. And it just turned out that I found this. And, you know, now psychologists are saying, you know, victims of childhood trauma, you know, the way to deal with it is coming to believe, especially, you know, sex abuse for young women, isn't just through the talking about it, but it's through doing mental things and activities that allow you to deal with it. But maybe I just kind of latched onto that at a very young age.
Yeah, definitely. It makes sense. So you kind of were self-coached as you went through your years at Yale. What did you do in your training to keep getting faster and faster?
Well, for all those runners out there, it's called interval training. And the other thing is, for whatever reason, and people are not going to like me for this, I loved it. I loved interval training because it was quantitative. And in the same way that I found running as a release. And when I was in college, I discovered that, you know, so much of what we're doing is deferred gratification and open-ended in terms of goals. And where along the line are you really reinforced as to, you know, how well you're doing and how good it can feel? Whereas I found that, you know, and that running every day was something I did. And I finished it and was completed every day.
Right.
And the interval training, I approach the same way. If you think about it, interval training is wonderfully quantitative and the watch doesn't lie. And if you keep the records and you do the right kind of training, and if you're self-coached the way I was, and you keep refining and trying things and working on your strengths, I think that was the main thing for me. I realized I was very good at running very fast on these intervals, but also with very short recovery. And I also realized I recovered very fast from day to day.
Ah, interesting.
And for instance, my morning run, once I got out of college and was training, and by the way, I went to law school in Florida and ran 20 miles a day training for the 72 Olympics. I was in law school full-time and ran 20 miles a day. And it was something that was tangible. And so you could get that reinforcement every day. But like I said, just as I love moving across the ground, I just loved hard interval training because it was such an indication of what your level of fitness was. I could tell from my interval training records pretty much how fast I could potentially run from 5,000 meters all the way through the marathon.
Wow.
On any given day. And I trained like a 5,000 meter runner. That was the other key all year round. So I did not run a step of speed training slower than I wanted to run in a 5,000 meter race on the track, even when I was training for marathons.
Now, you said in the book also that you went really easy on your easy days and hard on your hard days. You think that was a key as well?
Yes, it was. Because, and I always look for mentors. When I talked about as a young child being outside looking for other people, I was looking for good, normal people in wonderful, loving, normal situations. And so I think I developed a way of looking for good people as mentors. And all the way along, I found it in prep school, one of my coaches, a guy named Warren Hall. Then, you know, when I got to Yale, Bob Gegengack, the coach, was my mentor because his theory was to teach you how to coach yourself. Because at that time, if you went to Yale, you certainly weren't going to have a career as a runner after because that career didn't exist. And so he later told me after, you know, the Munich Olympic marathon, he said, you know, you were making up your own workouts for the middle of your junior year. And the mentor in Florida, when I first got down there, I mean, if you're going to try to make the Olympic team and you're fresh out of college, well, why not go down to Florida where the guy who had just beaten you in the 2 mile, like a drum, beat me like a drum in the open 2 mile was a guy named Jack Batchelor, who was on that 68 Olympic team in the 5,000 meters. And so I went down to Florida to train with him. And he is the one who taught me how to go very slowly on easy days.
Right.
And so I hope what's coming through here is that I would always look for people to help. And just to carry the Batchelor story on a little further, within about a year, the 1970 cross country, so the next fall after I had graduated, about 18 months later, I won the national cross country championship and Jack finished second. And so I had sort of gone beyond my mentor. And then 2 years later in 72, Jack finished ninth in the Olympic marathon.
Wow.
And then Kenny Mora finished fourth, became one of my very good friends and training partners. And I think what this brings up here for your listeners who I know are running oriented is it really, and at that time, and I think we went through a phase after that where it wasn't true. But at that time, we truly supported each other.
Right.
I mean, when Steve Prefontaine and I were hammering each other, training on the track, and then trying to beat each other's brains out on the track and in the race, when we weren't doing that, we were cooperating in the training, trying to just do the other in the racing. And then all the other time we were together, the switch went off.
And that probably made both of you better as athletes and as people.
You get much better training with someone like that. And so again, I think I had a realization with that early on, but it has to do with a willingness to share. And then again, for your listeners, the other thing it has to do with, I think you have to be confident enough to be willing to lose doing it.
Yeah.
So when I'm training with Steve on the track and we're just, you know, going at it, I'm not looking for ways to beat him. You know, I'm in a race. I'm trying to get myself as ready as I can to race him when the time comes. And I think there's a distinction there. I think there's something Because as you pointed out, it's the cooperation at that point that matters rather than looking for weaknesses and holding back and not giving all. And so, and sharing the load. And I think that's what I would advise any runner out there is listening. Find someone of equal ability who's willing to share the load and keep them.
Right. That's very good advice. Running community is amazing and can definitely help you take your running to the next level. That's for sure.
Right.
Well, let's go back to the track workouts for a second. When you were training for the Olympic marathon and you were doing interval training, what did that look like? Because I know a lot of us don't take time to go to the track. So
right.
For the uninitiated, what did those workouts look like?
Well, just to preface it, I look for maximum return on the intensity.
Okay.
And I also had a theory of the faster your legs can go in your training, then the pace you're going to run in the race, the more comfortable you're going to be at race pace.
Okay.
That's it.
Right.
It's very simple. I go in for simple stuff. And like I said, I trained on the track all year round as if I were going to run 5,000. That's why I could train with Steve Prefontaine. We did. Bill Dellinger, his coach, and Bill Bowerman, and my coach, Bob Geege, I've had the same theory. And so I trained all year round as if I were going to race 5,000 meters. So I trained so I could walk out the front door on any given day of the year. And if I peaked, I could go left and try to run my best at 5,000, or I could turn right and try to run my best for the marathon.
You say back in the book that the 70s, the marathon was like the white whale of track and field. Is that kind of why you trained so much, you know, for the 5K and maybe the 10K?
Yeah, I was still at that point a 10K racer, and I was going to try to make the 72 Olympic team.
Okay.
But unfortunately, for himself, Kenny Moore convinced me that I should try the marathon because I thought I'd be good at it because we trained together. And the marathon trial for the 71 Pan Am Games was a month before the track trials. And so I literally ran my first marathon as a hedge against not making the team at 10,000 meters. But you see, the fortunate part for me was part of my training, Jack Batchelor ran 20 miles every Sunday, and he ran it however he felt like running it. So for a year after I went down to Florida to train with him, we ran 20 miles every Sunday. And so in essence, I'd been doing my long run for marathon training.
Yeah.
So to put it all together, all year round, I would run twice a week on the track, and my intervals would never be more than 5K worth of hard running. In other words, 3 miles. And the pace would never be slower than 65 seconds a lap. So if I did interval miles, each one had to be 420 or better. And then worked on the recovery to be as short as possible. Now, recovery was just trying to come as close to no recovery needed at all as possible. That's sort of the way I looked at it. I can give you an example. I mean, you can always edit this stuff out if you want, but if your listeners, I got to where I could run 12 times 400 meters starting out at maybe 62 and finishing at 59 or 58. At sea level, no, I would jog 50 meters between each one.
That's not much recovery at all.
No. And so, you know, and that was sort of the goal. And the other part of it was to set up a training that worked so much to my strengths, which was recovery, that I could get to a point where I felt that very few people against whom I was competing would be able to do this kind of workout.
Right. So tell us about that first marathon a little bit that you competed in. I mean, it didn't exactly, you know, go ideally, I suppose.
No. I was wearing a pair of shoes that I had to tape around the outside because they weren't narrow enough. I have narrow feet. Mm. And Kenny and I were motoring along. We were running about, I even forget the pace. I think we ended up running 2:15 and 2:16.
Which marathon was this?
This was the Pan Am Marathon Trials 1971 in May in Eugene. And again, to show you how going in, I didn't have the money to fly out there from Florida, and they didn't pay way, but my coach had been the coach of the 64 Olympic team. And one of his athletes was Dave Maggard, a shot putter who got the bronze medal, who was athletic director at Cal. And they had a track meet at Cal, an open track meet. And Maggard flew me out from Florida, and I ran a 5K on Saturday and then flew to Eugene to run my first marathon on Sunday.
Good thing you recovered.
So that's how
fast.
I got out there. Yeah. And so that's it. But I found that's what I could do.
Yeah.
I ran many races in consecutive days. And that just started in high school. I would always double. And then in college, I always doubled. And in my first national championships, I doubled Friday and Saturday, 10K on Friday and 5K on Saturday. I practiced it in a way so much that it never dawned on me that I would be tired.
Right.
You know, I never thought about the fatigue factor, but I had never gone beyond 20 miles. So I didn't know about glycogen depletion or anything else.
Sure.
And so I'm running along with Kenny and we're way ahead. And in about 22 miles, I suddenly realized, oh, this is what it feels like. And the quote, and this is my sense of humor, which Kenny has sort of chronicled in his Sports Illustrated writing. I turned to him at 20 miles and said, Kenny, why couldn't Fidipides have died here?
Yes. said,
well, why couldn't it have been 22 miles from Marathon to Athens?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
and so I sort of crawled in after he beat me by a minute, but then I didn't lose another marathon until Montreal. What was that? 5 years later.
So how much attention was given to marathons in those days? You refer to it as the white whale of track and field. It's kind of a rare beast.
Well, yeah. And part of the reason to run it was Kenny seemed to be very normal.
Seems.
Whereas at the time, the enclave of what at the time were the best marathoners in the country sort of held themselves out as a group of people that did the special thing that you had to have certain mental and physical qualities, but particularly mental qualities in order to be able to do. And my thought was, bleep, I run 20 miles every Sunday.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. And so in a way, it was this sort of, you know, I just wanted to see if these people who thought they were so special were really that special.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And yet I had this great friend, like I said, who was a very good marathoner. He was, you know, on the Olympic team in 68 in the marathon 4 years before. And I said, this guy's pretty darn normal. and so he's the one who talked me into doing it. The first thought I had when I finished second, so I qualified for the Pan Am Games, was my first thought, now I have to do this again.
Oh, dear. Take us to the 1972 Munich Olympics. That was a big games for a number of reasons. Kind of remind us what happened during that period of time.
Well, I ran both the 10,000 meters and the marathon because I did that at the Olympic trials in 72. And at that time, the Olympic trials were the same time frame as the current Olympics in Rio.
Okay.
So the marathon trial was actually the last day of the track trials in 1972.
Wow.
So I ran a trial race of the 10,000, the final of the 10,000, and then ran the marathon at the Olympic trials. So in Munich, I knew it just seemed to me, well, that's what I did and it worked, so I'll do it again.
Right.
And it didn't dawn on me the recovery time between the 10K and the marathon. Well, the other part of the story is that we were always sort of rebellious, and there were five of us in a room together, four guys from Oregon. Kenny was there sleeping in the kitchen with a cot. I was in a room, and two of the Oregon steeplechasers, Steve Savage and Mike Manley, were there. John Anderson, who'd gone to Cornell but was from Eugene, so there was this big Oregon connection. And then there was Dave Waddell and me sharing a room in that rooming complex. And our room had a door out to a balcony. Well, after Dave Waddell won his 800 meters, he was done. And so he had his gold medal up on the dresser, and he had just been married. So we forged credentials and got his wife into the Olympic Village, and they were occupying our room.
Right.
And I had dragged my mattress out to the balcony to sleep outside because it was had an overhang. And, you know, again, never thought about it. I was only going to run the Olympic marathon in a few days,
no
but
big
what
deal.
The heck? I camped out. No, that was no big deal. And so I was out on the balcony, and about 4 o'clock in the morning, I heard the shot. I heard the big first shot when they were shooting through and breaking down the door, the terrorists in the Israeli quarters.
Wow.
So I heard it, and I said, that's a gunshot.
Right.
And I went back to sleep, and I woke up, and the way I've always described it is, it was just like being in the jungle when there's a predator. Down below, there was no sound. I couldn't see down below. I had to get up to look over the wall, you know. But there was no one below in the Olympic Village. And I said, boy, went inside, and there everyone was hovered around a small television set. And Steve Prefontaine, his mother was from Germany and was fluent in German. And growing up, Steve may have actually had German as a first language. So he translated for us. And so we knew right away what was going on. And it was actually pretty darn accurate in retrospect. So we spent the day at first looking over there, just sort of thinking, what do we do, and talking. And we decided, it was a consensus. We're going home. You know, the Olympics are over. Nothing's worth human life. You know, it's hard to describe. And then when you talk about people sort of coming together, there was a runner from Ethiopia who is now a physician in Southern California, by the way. His name was Hailu Ebba. He was from Ethiopia running the 1500 meters, and he was from Oregon State. And there's a knock on the door, and he comes in because he was looking for comfort and for people he knew.
Right.
You know, he didn't know the Ethiopian team. He knew the Oregon runners, you know? And we all hung around, ate, and then did the default thing that we do. We went running.
Right.
And when we went to the back gate of the Olympic Village, and this time the gate was shut, and the guards we got to know over time were carrying guns. So we looked at them, had eye contact, and climbed the fence and ran. And that's how we dealt with that first day. You know, it was how we deal. And how different is that from the way I'd always dealt with things? You know, that was what I always did. And the next day we found out that the Olympics were going to carry on. And we knew it was the right thing.
Right.
And I made the decision, and I told Kenny, I said, you know, Kenny, the only place any of the terrorists can do anything here more is out on the marathon course. And I'm not going to think about it. If I do, they win. I ran the entire Olympic marathon and never once thought about it.
And that was intentional. I mean,
yes, I made the decision not to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something, again, I developed over time.
As a coping strategy, yeah.
Absolutely. I could walk out the front door of my house, which was a prison, and that was it. I was not going to think about what was back in there. I was going to deal with that over which I had control moving forward at that moment.
You know, it was interesting as I was reading your account of the terrorist attack there at the Olympic Village, that no one came into your guys' room, no, you know, official or one of your coaches to say what was going on and to give you guys instructions.
Yeah. But on the flip side, the person who would have been there and could have was, but he did something even better, was Bill Bowerman. Mm-hmm. Bill Bowerman, early on, when he saw what would happen, he was 10th Mountain Division, right? Mm-hmm. World War II, Army veteran. He went right to the U.S. delegation and then wound his way up to the IOC and said, this is the real deal. You have to up the security here. You've got to protect these athletes. And so part of the reason that no one was there, that Bill was out there, you know, reacting to the crisis in the right way. He was out there because, you know, given the choice of protecting your athletes by making these people do something or going up there and trying to console them, you know, I vote with going going for the safety.
Sure.
But the other thing is, I think he had a faith in his athletes. You know, again, the athletes at that time were very, very independent, and they had to look out for themselves and learn to be on their own, you know, in the lead up.
Yeah.
And many of these people, John Powell, for instance, who got the silver medal in the discus, was a San Jose policeman. I mean, that was his job. And so he knew, you know, and so I think that's what it was. But I think the main thing was there was no outside communication. Mm-hmm. You know, the phone lines wouldn't work. We never used the phone anyway. And there were no cell phones.
Right.
And so all we had was our little black and white TV.
Yeah, as I'm reading your account, it's like such a huge contrast from the Olympic Games, which are going on as we speak. Just the difference between how the athletes are treated now versus how, like you said, how independent you had to be back then. And, you know, like just going into that Olympic marathon, anyone would have said that, wow, that would be so much to shake your mental game. And you just didn't allow that to be part of your reality. You know, you still followed your plan to surge around mile 9 and just, you know, hang on. And after that, so as you came into the Olympic Stadium, another kind of unusual thing happened. Tell us about that.
Well, it turns out that a young 17-year-old German high school student had a buddy who'd been driving a golf cart around the track and field venue for 9 days, servicing the pop stands. So he hopped on the back of his golf cart with a numbers scribbled on a piece of paper. And he jumped off the golf cart as his buddy drove by the tunnel that leads into the stadium. He ran down onto the track. And his timing, in retrospect, was perfect. Because he got down there, it turns out I've timed it. He was 48 seconds ahead of when I hit the track. So I was just outside the tunnel, and I heard this roar. And I thought, oh, and at that time, the marathon was the last day of track and field. And so I thought, well, you know, the high jumps run long, and someone made a height in the high jump. It's still going on. So I said, okay, here it comes. And I ran down the tunnel. I ran out onto the track, and it was silent.
Oh,
it was silent.
You're like, what is going on?
I went, what? Okay. And the thought, I swear, that the thought that went through my mind was, geez, I'm an American, but give me a break.
Yeah.
I just thought that maybe people had been expecting someone from some other country, you know, from the Rift Valley or Oceania or Northern Europe or somewhere. And, you know, Americans weren't the ones you would expect. And then there was sort of a mumble. And so at 48 seconds, when I came in and the tunnel opened up right at the start of the 100, you made a right-hand turn, ran the 100 meters to the finish and ran another lap.
Okay.
So I made a right-hand turn. Well, when I made the right-hand turn, this imposter kid was at the halfway mark on the track. So he was out of my field of vision. He was just far enough ahead. And so I hit the finish line, started my last lap around, and by the time I got to the backstretch and could see, he had already finished. And people started to whistle. And in Europe, whistling's booing. And I thought, geez. Then somebody from the stands with this wonderful American accent said, "Don't worry, Frank." And I thought to myself, why should I worry? I'm winning.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going. And then I finished. And someone came up to me as I was sitting down on the track, pulling the tape off my arches. I always tape my arches, and it was the days before pre-wrap, so a lot of skin would come off with the tape. So I'm sitting there sort of bleeding on the track. And before he asked me to get off, the person said, "What'd you think about that guy?" And I knew exactly what had been going on. But things have been left out of the narrative, you know, that we're talking about and what's been written. And what I didn't talk about there was how that affected me long term. And it never has. It never did at the time. And I've come to realize, and I hope it is, because that's not the reason I ran the race. I didn't run the race for the roar. That wasn't one of the objectives. In fact, it wasn't something I don't think I ever thought about until I was in the tunnel. You know, it was probably the first time I'd ever thought about it.
Yes, all the attention and applause you'd get.
Yeah, I don't think I ever visualized it. It wasn't part of my visualization process because, you know, that's, to me, that's not what is going to work anyway. You know, you visualize being out there, putting out an effort, carrying out your strategy. That's what you do when you visualize. You don't visualize going through the tape.
Yeah.
and so what I've come to realize over time is many people thought and had empathy for me because they thought maybe for a little while I would think I wasn't winning.
Right.
But I never thought that. You know, I always knew I was winning.
So you won gold in the Olympic marathon. What was your finishing time?
2:12:19.6, I think.
Wow. So how many Americans have won gold in the Olympic marathon before or since?
Well, Johnny Hayes from the U.S. won in 1908 when the first place finisher, Pietri from Italy, had come in staggered and the officials had directed him the right way. He collapsed to the ground a few meters from the finish line. And the officials picked him up and carried him over the finish line and disqualified him.
Oh, man. Thanks.
Yeah. So, and Johnny Hayes was moved up to first. And I won in 1972. And no American man has won since. Joni Benoit Samuelson obviously won in 1984.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And my theory on the marathon is, and in both times I went into the Olympic marathon, I said, look, there are 10 people in this field, and I can look at them. And I know they have the potential to win, but only three of us are going to have a good day. And I just have to be one of those three. And so that's always the way I approached it.
This would be a good time to tell you about our episode sponsor, the Tallahassee Marathon. We've really heard great things about this marathon, and we're excited to feature them on the podcast. It looks like they're really going out of their way to make this race special for runners. Tallahassee Marathon is now in its 43rd year, but only the second year of its brand new course through Tallahassee's best sights and sounds. The course is one of the most challenging in Florida, with rolling hills and canopy roads that distinguish Tallahassee from the rest of the Sunshine State. And here's something to look forward to. Beer will be served for all finishers, and there will be a Finish Line Festival concert.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's right. Tallahassee is now one of the few marathons in the country with a permanent finish line. The city showed so much support for the new course, they decided to make sure the finish line would always be in beautiful downtown Tallahassee.
It's kind of like Boston. There's a permanent finish line at the Boston Marathon.
Yeah, that's really neat. It shows the community really gets behind it. And the Tallahassee Marathon is not for profit. Proceeds from the race benefit Gulf Winds Track Club and the Hang Tough Foundation, which supports the entire family unit of children facing life-altering illnesses and special needs. So the race is holding a contest for a VIP prize package, including a training plan, a one-night hotel stay, 2 race entries, and other goodies. So visit their Facebook page to enter the contest, and remember that it ends on October 15th. But you are allowed multiple entries, so make sure you head over and like their Facebook page and enter the contest.
So let's go now to the 1976 Olympics, which was in Montreal. It does predate Angie and I. We weren't born yet. But tell us about that marathon experience.
Well, in the Munich race, I had planned to use my track training to turn the marathon into a track race. Hmm. So I surged at 10K race pace at 9 miles, and no one went with me. I got away. I ran very well to mile 17. Had a minute and a half lead, and by the end, I was over 2 minutes. So I had done essentially what they do in track races sometimes, which is surge and then just hold it.
Yeah.
And I think I'd caught people by surprise. I think Kenny had an idea when I did it what I was going to try to do, but that wasn't his kind of race strategy. That's not the way he raced. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I think everyone was pretty surprised. In Montreal, I had, in the interim, been undefeated in the marathon and won the Fukuoka marathon race in Japan, which at that time really was the world championships. It was they didn't have the big city races yet, and it was the only time that the Eastern Europeans would emerge to run against the West.
So it was kind of a bigger deal even than the Boston Marathon.
Yeah, yeah. And it was the world championships. The world didn't show up at Boston. Mm-hmm. They showed up at Fukuoka. And I had won that race 4 times. Mm. And, well, 3 times after the Olympics. So people kind of knew, and I would run very hard in the first half. My PR for the half marathon is my halfway time in the Fukuoka marathon.
Okay. Nice. Puts into perspective.
Yeah, they didn't have many half marathons. My PR in the half marathon is 103.30, which was my halfway time all by myself when I was out in the lead in Fukuoka. So that was the way I ran. And so by then, 1976, everybody knew how I ran.
They knew your strategy.
So the strategy became, I'm going to do it. And you know, I'll do it sometime. And anyone who wants to try to come along can try to come along. But I think, again, this is a program where I think the listeners are more tuned into training. I really had confidence through my interval training and still feeling that I was one of the best, if not the best, at that kind of racing, mm-hmm. because of my ability to recover from a very fast surge, recover more quickly, and actually get back into a faster pace than I was before I surged. Mm. Because I trained for it. I would train on the track to do that. I would run repeat 800s, 800 meters, where I would run the first 200 meters, say in 35, in the middle 400 meters in 60, mm-hmm. and then the last 200 meters in 34, 33. And so I would train myself to slow down as little as possible, you see, after a surge. And so I said, okay, well, I'm going to do it. But the complicating factor was I had a stress fracture in my ankle that happened in February. And I didn't run the 10,000 in Montreal, and I saved it all for the marathon. So I was a little worried about that. But again, I ran the whole race, never thought about it. And so at 10 miles, I took off and someone went with me.
So you're surging and you look back and there's someone right off your shoulder.
Yeah, he stays with me. I don't recognize him. Never seen him before.
Not one of the elites that you thought were in that group of 10.
And all the elites knew each other.
Right.
Yes. And I thought he might be a fellow from Portugal who I'd watched in the 10,000 meters finish second to Lasse Vuren. And I was doing commentary on TV because I wasn't running in the race with Eric Siegel. And I said to Eric, either on air or during intermission, I said, that guy, you know, he'd make a good marathon runner. Turns out I was 8 years too early. I was talking about Carlos Lopes, who 8 years later won the Olympic marathon.
Amazing.
But he was running for Portugal in the 10,000 at the time. So I thought, God, and I didn't really know what he looked like. So I said, well, maybe Carlos Lopes jumped in for his first marathon. So I'm running along with this guy in the white singlet, and I keep surging, and he keeps going with me, and we're going back and forth, and I keep trying, and every time he just goes. And I'll never forget, we came down off of Mount Royal. We had to go up and down this point in the course, just around 20 miles. And we started into McGill University area, and this person just made a surge and started running away from me. And I tried to go with him, couldn't go with him. And then we made a left-hand turn to have a long, long straightaway, about 4 miles on an avenue back to the Olympic Stadium. And it was raining. And it rained the entire race. And it shows you again, it rained the entire race. I do not like running in the rain. I don't remember the rain. I don't remember. I don't remember the rain. And so we're running along, and I come back on him, and I got within about 50 meters. And at that time, it was kind of dusk, and there were lights coming on and everything. And I'll never forget, this guy turns around, looks at me. So at this point, I'm probably about 20 seconds behind. Mm-hmm. And he looks at me, and he turns around and runs right away from me. So we get to the stadium, and here's an interesting thing. You know, what do things happen for a reason? I have timed how much I heard the roar. I was outside the stadium. Of course, this person's ahead of me. And I thought to myself, I'm never going to hear this roar. I hit the track. Both times, I've timed it. Both times, this time, I was 48 seconds behind. Twice. I've been 48 seconds behind.
That's funny.
And came in, ran around, got to the finish line, did the lap. And it turned out this person was running an extra lap at full speed.
Oh, my goodness.
He didn't know how he was supposed
so
to run.
So were alarm bells going off in your head about his
performance? I'm going, what's going on?
You thought maybe he was taking a victory lap?
Yeah, no, that wasn't a victory lap. And so I actually waited at the finish line for him when he finished and shook his hand, because I always waited at the finish line for all the competitors. That's just what I did. And I'll never forget. He says to me, "Sprechen Sie Deutsch?" And I thought to myself, that's really strange for someone to Portugal to say that.
Like German.
Yeah, that's German. And it turns out it was a fellow named Walter Mar Cherpinski, who had run 6 minutes slower the year before. He had improved 6 minutes over his previous marathon time.
He was representing East Germany.
East Germany. And I waited 22 years and finally got the evidence that, and the evidence has emerged that the entire track team was on a government mandated, not even sponsored. It was mandated. It was, you had to be on the program. You had no choice. And so, and in fact, they've had East German athletes who have received compensation from the drug companies that made the drugs they took for their long-term health problems. So you sort of have to admit you took the drug in order to get the money.
Right. Exactly.
And so, but the point is, we knew, the swimmers knew, everybody knew.
How soon did you know?
I knew immediately when I knew it was East Germany. Hmm. I thought of the anecdotes that I'd heard already about female swimmers going to the first day at the practice pool, walking in the locker room, turning and running out, thinking she had accidentally walked into the men's locker room, and it was the East German women around the corner talking.
Oh, my.
In this particular Olympics in Montreal, were East Germans just really racking up medals?
I think they won more medals in track and field in the United States. Mm. You can check that, but I think that's true.
Okay.
And so, you know, it turns out that just recently they found that if the Russians had showed up in 84, there was a whole state-sponsored plan where they had figured that the steroids they were taking orally weren't good enough, and there was a plan to make everybody be on injectable steroids. But the point being, you couldn't say anything at the time, and so I essentially waited 22 years.
Wow.
Until there was enough information come out. But the coincidence there, and we can maybe even bring it up to USA Anti-Doping, yeah, was that this was early 1998. And I found, I had discovered, I knew about a East German cancer researcher whose wife had been a discus thrower, actually in East Germany, and she wouldn't be on the program. And so she had defected to West Germany, and he was the one who uncovered at lifetime risk, the Stasi files. When the wall went down in 89, he got access to these records that had been photocopied. And so the evidence came out. And so there's obvious evidence of people being on the drug program. And then, you know, when you talk about the argument, well, you know, you had no choice, you had to do it, or I had no idea what it was. It also turns out that the fellow who finished ahead of me was also, and he's admitted to it, being a Stasi informer. He informed to the secret police on his teammates because there was always the, you know, fear of defection. So it's sort of hard to argue that you had no way of knowing and didn't participate.
Exactly.
So Waldemar Sierpinski, coincidentally, is still alive. Has he ever came out?
No. He gets asked all the time, and he doesn't. Uh-huh. But I think the important part here, as it relates to, you know, our conversation now, is that I was always one of those people to wait until I could do something, you know, again, leading back to where I come from.
Right.
You know, do that over which you have control. Mm-hmm. So when I had this evidence, and then later in the year, it turned out that the White House and this fellow named Barry McCaffrey, General McCaffrey, who was President Clinton's drug czar, was very interested in this performance-enhancing drug program issue for whatever reason. So long story short, I got involved with the White House and helped to set up US Anti-Doping, which was a truly independent agency, and the very simple motto, you can't promote and police. And if you structure anything any other way, you don't really want to solve the problem. And so, and then 12 years later, the Armstrong situation, which I think validated US Anti-Doping in terms of, you know, who they are and what they do. But it was later on in the same year, it was 1998. So it was a question of just waiting for the windows to open and to have, you know, the right amount of information. And I think what I'm proud of is my role in this is that I think because of the way I'd waited and because of my background anyway, in terms of connections, you know, through college and everything else, I had a credibility that could be used when we all went to Washington to try to convince, you know, our representatives and senators that this was a legitimate program and that it really wanted to do something, which I think it's emerged that's the case. But again, I hope there's a flow and another thread here that kind of comes through.
Yeah. Now, as you follow track and field or, you know, any sporting events nowadays, I mean, how much skepticism do you view world records and things like that with, you know, the prevalence of doping in today's running world?
Well, I think, again, Jenny Simpson, who's come out just today, I was watching her on the telecast, and she's got the right approach. You know, it's very simple. U.S. Anti-Doping has been a model since 2000 on how you can do it. It just has to be independent, transparent, no conflict of interest, and funded in a way that no one has any interest. And they may keep trying to tell you they can't do it, but the International Olympic Committee could totally change the system. They try to say that, oh, we don't have control over this. Of course they
do. Yes.
Of course they do. Because all they hold the ultimate franchise. And they can say, if you can't create an independent agency, and USADA can be the model. And because very few other countries have that model. Of every other drug testing, most of them, particularly third world, Eastern Bloc, they're all connected to their federations. And there's a total conflict of interest. And the IOC has the power to say, nope, got to be independent. Guess what? We're actually going to spend some money to audit this on an ongoing basis by independent people to make sure you're doing it. And your international federations for Olympic sports and the national Olympic committees have to go along with this outsourcing of the testing. And we're going to audit you frequently. And if you don't conform, you're out of the Olympics. They can do it. And so if they choose to, they could start tomorrow. But even when we were in the early days of USADA, and then I'll get off it, what we really had to come up with is the realization. And just as with our professional sports in this country, not to go into detail there, nobody wants to blink first. nobody wants to be the first because it puts you at a disadvantage. And your performance is going to be less if everybody else doesn't do the same thing at the same time.
Right.
But again, it all blends together. And I guess the way to sort of sum it up is I'm a huge fan. I'm watching all the Olympics. And in my own mind, I know because I know the way Jenny knows. I know the way Emma knows. I know the way Evan knows. They know. And so I view my job is to keep pressuring and to keep pressuring. And the idea that social media has made it so that Evan and Jenny can feel safe coming forward is a huge breakthrough.
Right.
Think about it. It's huge because the people with the power and who used to be able to control the spin through their PR can't do it anymore. Hmm. Social media doesn't allow it. People like you, what you're doing, and you know, all the other aspects of social media, you know, they're just too many sources. They can actually find a source with no dog in the fight.
Right.
What a concept.
Yeah, that is refreshing, and hopefully it will result in more, you know, openness and getting the sport cleaned up.
Just a couple more questions. You've been called the father of the American running boom. So what I'm wondering is, at the time when the running boom was beginning, did you and your colleagues have a sense that you were part of a boom?
No, I think our goal, you know, Don Cardon, who finished fourth, who should have been third in the 76 race, his way was to do it through a runner's organization. Kenny Moore's way was to do it through his writing. My way was to do it through the commercial way, which was to set up my own businesses in a way that first broke down the barrier of an athlete being able to endorse a product. In other words, we all wanted to try to find a way to make a living so that we could go back to another Olympics. You know, at that time, you were allowed one, and that was it. And then you went on and did some, is it, the French would call it, you were allowed your only diversion, or they call it divertissement. It's a great word. And, you know, your little jaunt out and then back to reality, the real world, get on with your life. And those of us at the time didn't want to do that. And so we wanted to keep in the sport. So we had to create our own way of earning a living and staying on in the sport. And so we were all doing it. But I think I stood out from that because, in a way, maybe no more than due to the fact that Rune Arledge, for whatever reason, who was head of ABC Sports at the time, decided to focus on the marathon in the 72 telecast, you know, and maybe because I kind of was the favorite, but I wasn't really presented as the favorite. And so I think that had something, but I also think it had to do with we kept on. And so we went another 4 years, and the running boom started to take off about 1974, 75. And I think the first major road race that was like that was the Falmouth Road Race, which is coming up this weekend.
Yeah.
And that's when Bill Rogers and I were brought down by a bartender from Boston named Tommy Leonard, who was a running fan when he wasn't tending bar. And so Bill had won the Boston Marathon the previous spring in 75. And so we all went into the 76 Olympics with the two best marathoners in the world. And in the fall of 76, Bill and I ran New York, and Bill won convincingly. And I think that first five borough race, where it suddenly became apparent that, my God, they can even shut down the streets of New York to run a marathon. You know, and at the time, who would have thought? What maybe was different about me and my contribution to this running boom was, I think when I won in Munich, it demystified the marathon for a lot of people. They said, oh, he can do it. You know, an American can do it. He looks pretty normal. He's kind of skinny.
You were more relatable then.
Had long hair and a mustache.
Yeah. And the fact that you can do it, you know, it again, inclusive aspect and the demystification that came out, at least in that first wave of the running boom. And then it just expanded and just went right across the demographic. And now you have more women out there.
That's right.
So,
well, I think you've been a great ambassador for the sport. You know, we appreciate all your contributions towards it. If you could give some advice to a first-time marathoner, maybe someone who's thinking about running their first marathon or even just training for their first marathon, what would it be?
Well, I hope they've been running long enough that they've found out that they truly like the running for what it is. I think it would be very difficult to train for a marathon if you really didn't like doing the training.
Good point.
You know, the point of it being, it can't be only a goal-oriented situation. That would be so hard. I couldn't imagine you know, being able to set up a program where you start from ground zero and over, I would say, the course of a year build up to, you know, getting 5K races, 10K races, finally do a half marathon and then run your marathon. If you really didn't enjoy it, that would be tough. But if you do find out, and the other thing I would say is, you know, the marathon isn't the only thing out there. And I've always told parents to start with, you know, let your kids try all different sports because they'll find the motion, the biomechanical motion that they like the most. You know, it might be the bike, it might be swimming, it might be running. Who knows what it is? If you find it, no, you kind of like it. It doesn't even have to be your favorite, but you like it. Many, many of the local specialty running stores around the country have running groups. And I would suggest that you link up with one of those because nothing beats peer group pressure to get you out
That's
there.
That's right.
And by now, the body of knowledge is such that people really know how to do it. The other thing is, each time you make a step up from the 5K to the 10K, 10K to half marathon, and then to the marathon, run the first one, at least the first one, to finish it.
Right.
That's all. That's all. Yeah. Just run it to finish it. And the way I would suggest they do it is find somebody who's at your pace and carry on a conversation in a way that you don't have to draw in a breath, that it can be just as the way we're talking now. Right. You want to have that first try at that distance, at that effort. And see, I've always gone by perceived effort. I never worry about time. And then give it enough time in your training and run that first one. And even in that first one, I always tell people, even if it's your first and you're going to go easy, the gun goes off in that first 2 or 3 miles, find the effort at which you think you can finish and then back off 30%.
Yes.
Yeah. Because at 22 miles, you're going to have the same experience I did in my first marathon. And if you back off 30%, you'll get to 22 miles and you'll thank me.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And so it really is that learning of what it's like to be out there. And then the last piece of advice is from 22 miles in your first marathon, I think your perception of how much you're slowing down is distorted. I don't think you really slow down as much as you think. And I think it's because you're burning more fat than glycogen, you know, before that point. And so really don't worry about it. Just relax and go with it. And then finally, maybe there's one other point that I haven't brought up lately, but again, anyone, when I tell people this, people nod their heads. The British, even in all your races leading up to it, but particularly when you get to the 10K and the half marathon, there are periods in anyone's race that the Brits have a great word for it. It's called a bad patch, where you're going along and you just start feeling crappy. And you go, oh my gosh, I have so much farther to go. And you learn that if you just keep not pressing hard, but just keep working forward and through it, you come out of that bad patch. And in other words, just stay with your perceived effort, even though it feels that, God, this is so hard. I can't. You find that you emerge from it because everyone goes through these physiological and sort of psychological swings during the race.
Yeah, that's excellent advice.
Wish I could practice it. Right now. No, I'm okay. I can run.
You're just probably not doing 20 miles a day anymore though, right?
No, I only work out once a day now. But I do something, usually spin, or I do a lot on the elliptical. I found one particular way on the elliptical where I can get my pulse rate up higher than I can running. So I do a lot of my hard training on that. But I mostly run, and I'm probably 30 to 40 miles a week. And then that's only half the exercise that I do. So I'm still, and I do for all the older people out there, and that means anybody over 35, I do a lot of strength training. But my advice on that is find a routine that works and you really feel like it's getting a pretty good job done. But don't make it so complicated and so long that you ever wake up looking for reasons not to do it.
Right.
And that has to do with your training too. You know, don't set up your hard interval training program on the day, you know, 8 interval miles on the track where you wake up and going, oh, bleep, I don't want to do that. You know, I never did that. Hey,
thanks for bleeping yourself, by the way, Frank.
Yeah, yeah.
It saves me time.
I set up workouts that I would not have a hard time mentally getting into, even if I were having a bad day.
That's good advice.
Yeah. And so in other words, tone it down on the interest of completion and consistency over time. Because then if you do it that way, you'll find you get into a certain workout, whether it's a tempo run or one of your long runs, which you normally do easy, or your track runs, that all of a sudden you're out there and you go, man, I'm on today. And you go for it, you know, wait for those days, but don't expect them every
day. Right. That's a good point.
Well, the book is called My Marathon, Reflections on a Gold Medal Life. Thank you, Frank, for taking time to speak with us, and good luck on getting that book out to all the masses. And I encourage people to go check it out. It's published by Rodale. It's a great read, and it's been fun hearing your story now, both reading it in the book and then getting to talk to you.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, we really appreciate your time. And
well, thank you. Thank you for your time.
Have a great afternoon. Thanks so much.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Frank Shorter. His website is frankshorter.net. And once again, the book is called My Marathon, and it's published by Rodale. Well, it's a great time to be a runner going into the fall season. Lots of marathons going on around the world. If you're going to be at the Berlin Marathon in Berlin, Germany this year, drop us a note. We're going to be there too. Maybe we can connect. We're planning a meetup. Nothing too big, but just a small informal meetup the day before the race. You can email us at trevor@marathontrainingacademy.com. And of course, we welcome you to connect with us on our website and on Facebook and everywhere that we're at. Thanks for being a listener. Stay safe out there. And remember, you do have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life.
Well on my way, well on my way. Oh, wait.